Hello and welcome to this week's Veto Edition special of the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio is...
Joe Manis with the St. Louis Beacon.
And...
Jason Rosenbaum with the St. Louis Beacon.
And reporting from Jefferson City, we have on the phone...
Marshall Griffin, your State House reporter, St. Louis Public Radio.
He's our very special guest for today.
Right.
Very special guest.
Although there's not a sen or a rep or a gov in front of his name. So.
Yes. No. So if
just a computer in front of my face.
Exactly.
Expert is in front of his name.
So if we sound groggy, it's for good reason.
I feel great.
Jason stayed in St. Louis while Joe and I and Marshall were out in Jefferson City last night. Ended up going until about midnight and then
yes.
Some interviews thereafter. But the big news, so surprising, we couldn't believe it, but 253 didn't have enough votes in the House. Who would have thought it?
The infamous tax cut bill
yes.
died. Actually, 15 votes short in the House, which... frankly, was more than some of the lobbyists who were keeping score before all the voting
right.
started. They weren't predicting quite that big of a blowout.
Well, I actually asked how many people on Twitter what they thought the final vote count would be. And Sean Nicholson of Progress, Missouri, I think said 95. And I think he might have been the closest to the pin there. So congratulations, Sean. You win nothing. Nothing
it was
at
94.
All.
It was 94. Now, 94 is a majority of the House. Let me make that clear.
But it's 15 not, votes short.
But it's not big yeah. enough. They have to have 109 in the House and 23 in the Senate to override a veto.
Marshall, were you surprised?
Well, I wasn't surprised that it didn't that it wasn't overridden. I was surprised a little bit at the margin. I've been hearing, half a dozen roughly were planning to vote no, and I know that Caleb Rowden was on the fence, but, he eventually voted yes. But 15 was a little bit of a surprise to me. I thought it would probably be maybe somewhere between 6 and 10.
Yeah.
And in some cases in this, and we can mention this in some of the other votes as well, I think that this also was a case where when it was clear that it was going down,
yeah.
you had some people, on some bills, it was politically prudent to vote yes. And some bills, depending on your district, it was politically prudent to vote no. So if it's going down, I think there are some people who maybe didn't really want, since they saw it wasn't going to win anyway, they're like, why should I get my superintendent and school board upset? Because, most of the school boards and superintendents were against 253. So some people who might have said, well, I'll vote for it, then decided why. And so then they bailed. And I saw that on some other bills,
but
too.
But look at who voted for it. Yes, there were people like Elaine Gannon and Kent Hampton who won by very small margins last time. But there were also people that effectively ran unopposed. I don't think Don Phillips had a Democratic opponent. I don't think Jeff Messenger had serious Democratic competition. It was a pretty solid mix of vulnerable Republican state reps and people who really have no chance of losing to Democrats, which kind of underscores how much of a collapse it was in support. I've been saying for weeks, and not to pat myself on the back, although that's exactly
although he's
what
doing
I'm doing.
That, we're all...
Yeah, let's all pat Jason.
But I remember back in June when we were still doing this type of format that I thought that it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to override this bill. You just look at the numbers where it was back in May. There were three Republicans that voted against it. There were three Democrats that voted for it who were unlikely to vote for an override. And they didn't, by the way. Jeff Rorta, Ed Schieffer, and Steve Hodges voted no on this. So unless you got those three Republicans to switch sides, then there was no chance of overriding the bill. And not only did that happen, because none of those three – did either.
Right.
It expanded by a lot, which signals to me that there were so many things about this bill that became unpalatable that it just wasn't going to happen.
It was I think when they realized that there was a sales tax increase for prescription drugs and college textbooks.
Well, let's talk about that for a little bit. So who do you think gets the credit or gets the blame in this situation? You had Nixon going on a PR campaign. You had the accidental sales tax exemption being removed in the bill. You had education leaders criticizing the bill. You had credit agency findings that said it could harm the state's AAA credit rating. You had the attorney general's memo saying that parts of it could be retroactive.
But that was near at the end.
So who do you think gets the most credit in this?
What do you think, Joe?
I want to emphasize, I am not necessarily an apologist for the governor, but I think in this case, he should get a decent amount of credit because the guy barnstormed the state, continued to barnstorm the state, and he or his allies put together this coalition of education groups and stuff like that. And one of the significant things about that is that this is not something that Nixon normally does.
Exactly.
Nixon has won statewide by large margins most of his political career, but he has never been known as a team player or Big Ten guy. And the fact that he crafted this together and really just drove it into the ground, and some of it may have been that he was had his eye on Rex Ziegfeld, the wealthy financier who financed the ad campaign in favor of the override. Nixon may have seen this as a case where if he could succeed, that this might discourage Ziegfeld from doing this on something else. I don't know if that's true. But what I'm saying is I think you've got to give the governor in this case, whether you like him or not, a decent amount of credit for what happened.
So the bill is dead for this year, but it is going to be back next session, according to House Republican leadership. What changes do you guys think they're going to make other than obviously taking out the sales tax problem? Do you see them?
I do think they'll try to address maybe the language that made it retroactive to 3 years.
Right.
I think there will definitely be a push to do that. Although it wouldn't surprise me if maybe some of the leadership decides to stick with some of these things, maybe one or two of the things that the governor vetoed, just to throw it in his face a little bit.
That's a possibility. This will be in the answers to my five things to look for tomorrow. But I do think if they come back with a bill that addresses the concerns that caused all these people to vote against it, for example, taking out the sales tax for prescription drugs, the retroactivity question, maybe just making the bill less janky. Is janky a word?
Janky is a word.
I not to disparage it or its handlers, but there were some problems with it. I think that may change the situation a little bit. And I agree with Joe. I think that if Nixon had just vetoed this bill and remained complacent about it, I think he stood a real risk of causing those Republicans to change their minds and maybe those Democrats who voted for it not to change their minds. I think if he hadn't come out and highlighted that prescription drug thing, I think that was a critical juncture in this. It basically gave those three Republicans no incentive to change their mind. And it basically told Schieffer, Rorta, and Hodges that, you know, if I vote for this, I'm essentially now voting to override a bill that raises sales taxes for prescription drugs, which is a key, you know, element for anybody to win a tough election. So I do think he deserves some credit. I do think the education groups, though, were also important.
Exactly. And I think, though, the compromise, I mean, well, we don't know if it'll be a compromise, but the next version, I'm wondering, I'm no expert on this, but I'm wondering if they might either reduce some of the cuts, let's say for business, and from 50% to, let's say, a third or whatever, because they do have, I mean, now all these school districts and all these school officials, they all got together, banded together, and that's a lot of stuff that really put pressure on some of these rural legislators.
Yeah.
The business interests in the state are going to have to deal with that. I mean, and trying to just beat them might not be the way to do it. It might be that they need to be, because in most of these small towns, the superintendent and the business leaders are in the same Rotary clubs or Kiwanis or whatever. They may need to craft some sort of middle ground so you don't have this kind of uproar, forgetting the sales tax thing. And also, I think it's going to depend what happens in Kansas, because they've been pointing out the western side of the state. They were saying this had to be done because the tax cuts in Kansas. Well, Kansas has had to make all these huge cuts in their budget. By next year, I think we'll have a better sense of whether or not the tax cuts in Kansas worked or if it's contributed to a real economic problem there. That could be a factor as they're trying to craft something.
Well, let's talk about the other big marquee bill being the so-called nullification bill. But before we get into what happened with it in the House and the Senate, Marshall, you were at a – Joe, were you at the rally as well?
I was just there at the very end.
So, Marshall, you were at the rally that took place this morning. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it was a rally to voice support for House Bill 436, the Second Amendment Preservation Act, or the gun nullification bill. You know, there were probably about 250 people there, and a number of people spoke. But the speaker that got the most attention was Republican Senator Brian Nieves from Washington, Missouri. He did something unique. He actually told the crowd to turn around. He pointed across the street. He was standing on the south lawn of the Capitol. He points across the street to the Supreme Court building, which also houses the office of Attorney General Chris Coster.
Just happens to.
Yeah, just happens to. Points across the street, tells the crowd to boo Chris Coster for his legal opinion that on House Bill 436, which he says was timed politically to scare police into opposing the bill, the police departments and sheriff's departments, to scare them into opposing this bill and not giving his, as Nieves later put it on the Senate floor, not giving the opponents, to his opinion, time to research it and come up with answers.
Now
counter the argument.
Now, we have something special on Politically Speaking. I think we actually have a clip of this, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
This is like a late night show. Let's go to the clip.
Yeah,
let's go to the clip.
The problems that we're having in terms of overriding this idiotic, stupid veto come from that office, from that man right there. So why don't you just tell him what you think of his antics over the last week? Go ahead, tell him.
But I was listening. I mean, I've been following this bill.
Sure.
I think a lot of people have, not only because of the idea in it that the state can nullify federal laws and criminalize federal agents for enforcing some of it. That got a lot of attention. But there was also a provision in there aimed at, you know, stopping the publication of gun ownership records or conceal and carry records in reaction to an article that got done in New York. But the statute there was written so broadly that it could potentially criminalize, you know, routine reporting. For example, if you had gone to that rally and somebody had said, I'm proud to own a gun or I'm proud to have a conceal and carry license, and you would have run it on the radio or written it down, you could make an argument because of the way that law was written that would be a misdemeanor. Now,
in fact, covering the rally, because you would assume that there were gun owners there, because it doesn't say, it basically said, you know, to report on any gun owner. In fact, at the governor's press conference, that the joke was, one of the reporters brought it up, that because he owns a shotgun, you know, the thing was, well, if this bill, because at this point when he had his news conference, the Senate killing hadn't happened yet. The Senate hadn't killed
the bill
yet.
Which we'll get there to in a minute.
But the point being, so it was still alive. And so the joke was, only half in jest, was that, well, if it passes the Senate, we won't be able to use your name anymore. We won't be able to refer to the governor because he's a gun owner.
Yeah, and I want to be clear here, and I was talking with Representative Funderburk, who was the sponsor of this. I don't think journalists necessarily have a burning desire to print lists of gun owners somewhere.
Correct.
I think that article in New York, for example, was not universally popular amongst journalism people.
Correct.
I think some of it thought it was completely irresponsible and was a threat to the safety of those gun owners. But on the other hand, this statute was written so broadly. I'm not an attorney, and I always say that, and I said that when I was talking about it with House Speaker Jones. But the way you read it, there's no exceptions for some things. And there could be situations, if it was ruled constitutional, which was doubtful,
yeah,
you know, where it could be a problem. But that wasn't the only thing in the bill. There was also stuff lowering the conceal and carry age. There was stuff dealing with gun buyback programs.
There was stuff about there was a debate of whether it required school officials to be armed or just said that they recommended.
I think it was a recommendation, but that's in the eye of the beholder. But
correct.
The thing, okay, we'll get to the part what happened to it.
Sure.
It ended up passing the House with 109
exactly,
votes.
The exact number.
And there were three Democrats that voted for it, which was crucial here because there were two Republicans that voted against it. So then it went to the Senate, where House Majority Leader Ron Richard had already said that he wasn't going to vote for it because
correct.
Of various constitutional concerns. And I had actually put on Twitter that I thought that was a pretty significant moment because I had thought that if he was going to vote against it, then somebody else would
too. They needed two Republicans to break ranks in the Senate.
And I honestly, though, I would have expected it to be someone like Jay Wasson, a Nixa Republican who is personally friends with Ron Richard and their close political allies, or somebody from the rural parts of the state. But it wasn't. It was Senate President Pro Tem Tom Dempsey, who ended up making the no vote that essentially killed that bill. And the rest is history, I suppose.
Well, what was interesting in the vote collection, and Marshall, you were there, so tell me if I got this wrong, but there was at least two Republicans who didn't necessarily vote during when they were going through the list, and then they asked them at the end. And I thought one of them was State Senator Eric Schmidt, who's from suburban St. Louis County, who we've had here on the podcast before, who represents a district that has been against concealed carry, although Schmidt is term limited. He's in his second term, but he is interested in running statewide in 2016. And then there was another state senator. I think it may have been Parson, but I could be wrong. But it was interesting to me, as the vote count was going, there was like basically two Republicans they skipped, and then when it was clear it was going down, then at the end the woman who was taking the vote then went to them, and then they both voted yes. But of course, they knew at that point that it was dying. Marshall, can you give any more details on what the I guess the strategy was there?
To me, I think the strategy was to give Republican members of the Senate a chance to vote for this, perhaps to give them some political clout back home in districts where it would be politically beneficial for them to vote for this, but at the same time doing what would be considered the responsible thing by the opponents of this bill and perhaps those who are friends of law enforcement, and that is to not allow this override to take place. And so you had something interesting. The President Pro Tem and the Majority Leader basically casting the two votes that killed this bill. And as it appeared, they did so in order to give the rest of their Republican colleagues the chance to, I guess, vote their conscience or vote their district or to vote their political interests in the next election cycle.
Well, here's what I don't understand about this. Now, I think that not everybody votes for something because, you know, an interest group is behind it. Maybe they actually believe it. I know when we were talking with Representative Colonna, he thought that Representative Doug Funderburk, you know, presented this because he really believed in this idea and what was in the bill. And I'm pretty sure there were a lot of members who fell into that category. And Nieves is probably in that category too. I do not doubt his sincerity on this. But, you know, I mentioned before that this wasn't a National Rifle Association-backed bill. They didn't say anything about it to reporters about whether they supported or against it.
In fact, during the vote counting, the NRA representative was not in the building, I was told. And I had been told a week ago by a high-level source that some representatives from the NRA had been calling certain legislators, telling them that this vote would not count towards their rating.
So that's my point. If a politically powerful group is not threatening on this particular bill, then besides just agreeing with the contents, why were people falling over themselves to vote for it, including the three Democrats I mentioned? You know, Ben Harris ran unopposed last time. Michael Frame had a close election, and I know Ed Schieffer is running for Senate, but if there's not going to be any blowback to it, they must either really believe in it and really think it's good, or they are just so fearful of voting against anything with gun in it that's their motivation. That was the part I didn't quite understand. But again, it goes back to the crux of that question. Sometimes people don't always vote for something because somebody's saying, hey, you better vote for this or you're going to be in trouble. Maybe they just believed in it. I don't know.
Well, I wondered, and I actually had tweeted this early in the day, and I'd be interested in Marshall's take on this, whether or not you might have had a few votes that were spooked by what had happened in Colorado the night before, where two prominent members of the state Senate, including the head of the state Senate, had lost their seats in a recall over two gun issues, totally unrelated.
But those were gun issues that were posed strongly by the NRA.
Correct.
That's the difference here.
Yes, I know. But what I'm saying is that here this vote's taken the day after, and you wonder if there weren't some who were spooked, even if it wasn't the case, where you had the NRA and the New York mayor and everybody else pouring money into the Colorado race. But you wondered if that may have affected a swing vote or two. I don't know. Marshall, did anybody ever bring any of that up?
Not that I had heard, but ever since the Newtown, Connecticut massacre last December, a horrible tragedy, there has been a feel, from what I've been able to detect, a kind of a mood of fear among gun owners and among gun enthusiasts that this was going to give President Obama or the Obama administration the excuse that they need to come after their guns and to come after to go after their rights to be gun owners and to be gun owners. You can edit that if you need to. So I mean, I think that was the driving force behind a lot of these different gun nullification bills, because House Bill 436 wasn't the only one, as we all remember. There was another one that would have made it a felony to try to challenge, enforce a federal gun bill. And so, I mean, I do think in part it goes back to what happened in Newtown and that renewed fear, because if you remember all the news reports of gun sales and ammunition sales going through the roof in the days and weeks after what happened in Newtown, Connecticut. So I do think that perhaps was part of the driving force behind why there was such a strong push to get this passed.
Now, we got to be fair here. We've spent a lot of time talking about several bills that didn't get overridden.
Correct.
But there were 10 that ended up getting overridden,
yes,
which might be a record.
It's a modern-day
record. Modern age. And
right.
You know, I remember during the end of session last year that detractors of Republicans wanted to say, well, this was a useless session. They didn't pass anything because Medicaid didn't pass or whatever. And I wouldn't be surprised if that same tact got put here because of those bills. But I think that there were significant bills that were overridden.
Absolutely.
This bill that limited liability to Doe Run, I think, is a very significant bill, not only because detractors of it point out that it, limits the criminal justice system in some instance to get restitution for various ailments dealing with these mines, if I'm not mistaken. It might not be mines.
So,
it might be something else. But we might need to explain it before we go.
Go ahead.
So what House Bill 650, what it would do would cap punitive damages at $2.5 million. It doesn't cap any sort of other types of damages. So if you're injured or anything like that, you can still get damages. Punitive damages are there more to punish a company for any sort of wrongdoing or negligence. For some perspective on this, Fluor Corporation, which owned a lot of the mines and the Herculaneum smelter before Doe Run, they had to pay $320 million 2 years ago because a jury awarded them that because they gave kids lead poisoning, according to the jury. So I mean, you're taking something that could be $320 million and you're capping it at $2.5 million. That's a huge win for this company.
Yeah.
Well, and what Doe Run officials, in fact, they had emailed me something this afternoon. They said they wanted to make clear that this was involving court cases that were for instances before they owned the company.
Yeah, that's what they say. That's up to some debate.
Right.
The people suing them would disagree.
That's
with
what
them
I'm
a
trying
bit.
To. That was what right. I was trying to say in my mumbled explanation of why it's important.
Yeah.
Some people would say that it's not good because of that reason. They could potentially get a lot more in damages, and they can't because of this bill. But some would say this could, spur economic development in a way, because I guess it would allow Doe Run to do some yes. sort of
so
thing.
So Doe Run says that now that they have some sort of shield law, that they can expand, that they can keep the 1,500 people that they have employed in Missouri, they can continue supporting the state economy. They say that they contribute about $1 billion to the state economy. And throughout the House debate, jobs were brought up. But also what was brought up was that this was something that happened in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and it happened before Doe Run came into ownership. The EPA would severely disagree with that.
Continue.
But labor was – a lot of there were some labor leaders who were in the Capitol yesterday lobbying in favor of the override. This was one case, the one bill where you had – labor, who are basically big Democratic backers and close to Nixon on most stuff, who were pushing for an override on this because they contended that it would save the jobs. Yeah. And then you had Congressman Lacey Clay, who I was told by some sources who was making calls to legislators trying to get them to stick, not vote for the override and stick with the veto, and that he was doing so at the behest of the governor.
But you look at the vote count on that too, especially in the House. That bill, again, that is an example of a bill that would not have made it to the Senate without Democratic support. And this was a more notable example, because I think there were like 5 or 6 or 7 Republicans who voted against it, a lot of them attorneys. But then you look at the people that voted for it. It wasn't just conservative Jeffco Democrats here. Yeah. I saw Janice Monticello voting for it. Yes. I saw Michael Butler voting for it. I saw Steve Webb voting for it.
Because the labor support.
And then in the Senate, you had Maria Chappelle Nadal, who voted for it, who actually
switched her vote.
And she actually voted to override, I think, on 10 or 11 bills. That's a kind of a subplot. Nasheed voted for it. Gina Walsh, another labor supporter, voted for it. And I think McKenna, Ryan McKenna, voted for it because it's in Jeffco.
Right.
So that was another example where it wasn't exactly party line either way. Other bills that got overridden, there was Maria Chappelle Nadal's video conferencing roll call bill, which she said on this show that she was thinking of overriding. So I want to just point that out to people, that we do break some news and predict the future here. There was also, you know, a few other bills as well. And I think that, you know, you can read all about them on our website.
Yeah, stlbeacon.org, and also on the St. Louis Radio.
My point being, I think all of the bills have some sort of tangible impact. I'm not sure about the holiday protection bill. I mean, that may have some impact.
Although
down the road,
I think that's going to prompt some court cases, because the opponents were contending that the way it was worded, that it would have prevented local governments, like last year where they canceled fireworks festivities for July 4th because of the drought, because the way the wording is, it bars any governmental agency from doing anything to affect holiday celebrations.
Yeah. And
is it going to turn the tide in the war on Christmas?
I don't know, but I will say, make a serious point on that. I did find it interesting that the governor vetoed that because he was fearful of invalidating 4th of July fireworks ordinances, but let that anti-foreclosure mediation bill that basically obliterated those two foreclosure mediation ordinances in St. Louis City and St. Louis County go into effect. So not saying it was a good or bad thing. I just found it was kind of interesting. But I think with that bill, it probably would have been overridden. So I think that was probably why the governor did that. So
I think the holiday bill will probably end up in court.
But my point being, you know, if you talk to Republicans, they're going to point to the 10 bills that got overridden.
Right.
But there is going to be a focus on the bills that didn't. I think that's kind of the general consensus, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, and the Missouri chamber is disturbed because one of the bills that got overridden was the one that Republicans and business had been pushing, which curbs the ability of uninsured motorists to collect damages if they're injured in an accident caused by an insured motorist. The insurance companies had really pressed hard on that one because they want to encourage more people to get insurance. And if they know that if they're in an accident and they don't have insurance, they're not going to be able to collect non-economic damages, that also may end up in the courts. But the House ended up killing another bill that would have changed workers. I mean, the
unemployment benefits, which was actually a pretty significant
bill.
And the
Missouri chamber came out with a statement within minutes, just really ripping the legislators for not voting for the override.
And if I'm not mistaken, that bill actually passed. There were two versions of the bill. The Senate passed one version, that the House didn't, and I'm assuming that since it didn't have enough support there, that they didn't really try to override it again, i.e. Right. they didn't try to get two bites of the same apple in the same veto session.
The chamber was extremely upset and issued a statement a few minutes after the House killed a bill that would have overridden the governor's veto of a measure that would have made it more difficult, according to critics, made it more difficult for people to collect unemployment insurance, because it did say that if you had violated rules on the job, that the company could get out of paying your unemployment.
Yeah. And again.
And the chamber claimed that this is going to lead to increased premiums on businesses as a result.
Well, it was an important bill that to the chamber that didn't end up getting overridden.
Yeah, and so that one rather was stunning. Everyone in the House, while we're watching the vote, that was surprising. That one did not make it.
I think that should just about do it for us. We'll be back next week. Hopefully we will have Senator Tom Dempsey.
The Senate chief,
and someone in the news at the moment, so he should be a good guest. You can follow me on Twitter at CS McDaniel. You can follow Joe on Twitter at
J Manis. It's J M A N N I E S.
You can follow Jason on Twitter at
J Rosenbaum.
You can follow Marshall on Twitter at
Marshall G Report.
You can read all of Marshall and I's stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can read all of Joe and Jason's stories at stlbeacon.org. We'll be back next week. Until then, so long.
So long.
Veto.